as we read through them, because it tends to let you see that Jesus Christ was a child, he was a young man, he was a young adult, he was a mature adult, and of course he was our Savior. And I don't know about you, but if you've ever had children, how many of you have children? Okay. Did you ever take your daughters and your sons, and did you ever hold them in your arms and ask questions about what they would look like and what they would become, who they would be? When they got a little bit older, did you dangle them on your knees and play with them and throw them up in the air and all those kinds of things? And you had to ask questions. Well, Mary would have been no different, would she? She would have been no different. So there's some more of those there. We've got them over there. Questions for Mary. Let's just read through here, and if we have a chance to just be sidetracked for a moment, we can maybe deal with one or two. Do you think, question number one, what was it like watching him pray? You know, do you think he would have prayed as a child? At a certain age, he would have begun to pray, would he not? I think he could teach us a lot about intensity. You suspect? And probably would like to be overheard. I'd like to overhear. Have you ever been caught praying? I mean, with your children, I got caught once. It just unnerved me. I didn't know what to do. My daughter walked into me. I didn't know whether to be embarrassed or whatever. And I finally came to the conclusion it was all right. Because if you're going to get caught doing anything, that's the thing to get caught doing. Now, how about this? How did he respond when he saw other kids giggling during the service at the synagogue? Because he took the services in the synagogue pretty seriously. You know. When he saw a rainbow, did he ever mention a flood? You think? Did you ever feel awkward? This would be Mary. Did you ever feel awkward teaching him how he created the world? That's something to think about, isn't it? When he saw a lamb being led to the slaughter, did he act differently? You think? Did you ever see him with a distant look on his face as though he were listening to someone you couldn't hear? That's almost sends your goosebumps. How did he act at funerals? You know, he would have acted differently at funerals than I think most of us would, because he had victory over death. If you know what I mean. I mean, to him, death was just a stopping point and would have been looked at a little bit differently than for a human being who did not understand the knowledge of the truth. Did the thought ever occur to you that the God to whom you were praying was asleep under your own roof? I'm talking about as they existed together at one time before Jesus Christ became the Son of Man. Did you ever try to count the stars with him and succeed? Well, there's Orion, and over there's this and that, and all of a sudden you're out and he's still numbering because he named them. You know, well, up there, you know, 1,000 later, he's still going on. That'd be quite an experience, wouldn't it? Did he ever come home with a black eye? What do you think about that one? Do you think he ever came home with a black eye? It's possible. I don't see him brawling. But accidents occur. You know, you're working as a carpenter. A wood chip can fly up and catch you in the eye or close to it. Or you could have banged into a... Yeah, the other kids could have gotten angry with him, sure. That's a possibility. How do you think he acted when he got his first haircut? Probably not like the average one of us when we got our first haircut. That's right. Yeah, according to the pictures, he didn't get his haircut. So he never got a cut, did he? Did he have any friends by the name of Judas? And the answer to that is probably yes. Just as much as Jesus was a common name, Judas was a common name as well. How well did he do in school? He probably did, I would guess, A work without any problem. Did Mary ever scold him? Yeah, I mean, she did. Remember when he was gone, he said, hey, she said, where were you? You know, when he was 12 years old and was left behind. I mean, there was a little bit of chiding in that. And it wasn't demeaning or anything like that. But probably when he was a little youngster, do you think that he might have rambunctiously gotten on her nerves? Because she was not perfect. And when you're dealing with imperfect people, they tend to, you know, chide a little bit, or, you know, they've been up late, or they don't feel well, and so on. So I suspect that maybe she might have chided him a little bit or scolded him. Did he ever have to ask a question about Scripture? He probably did, didn't he? You know, because to ask a question doesn't mean you don't know the answer. Right? Did he ever get angry with someone who was dishonest with him? Yeah. Did you, Mary, ever catch him pensively looking at the flesh on his own arm while holding a clot of dirt? Something to think about. Do you think that he ever woke up afraid? Well, that's a tough one to answer, isn't it? Because, you know, he would have known about Satan the devil and the demons and all that kind of thing. So that's sort of a trick question. I don't think he had anything to be afraid of, but I know he would have dreamed. I'm sure he would have dreamed. And when you dream, your subconscious mind brings up that which you have to deal with sometimes. Who was his best friend? John could have been a good friend of his cousin John. That comes up here later on. When someone referred to Satan, how did he act? Well, he would have known a whole lot about Satan because he would have known Satan from when he was first created. Did you ever accidentally, Mary, call him Father? Probably not. I don't know, because I think he would have settled that. What did he and his cousin John talk about as kids? Well, John, you're going to be out in the wilderness of Judea. I hope you like honey and locusts. Did his other brothers and sisters understand what was happening? Probably not. Interesting questions. You might talk to your children about those sometimes, or you might talk to each other about them. It allows your mind to expand a little bit and think about Jesus Christ and who he was and what he did and what he had to think about. Wouldn't you love the opportunity to go out on a moonlit night, or maybe not a moonlit night, but when the sky was clear and look at all the stars and just have him there and talk to him and listen to him? That maybe be an opportunity of ours one day. Now, there's a scripture here, actually a series of scriptures that all of us have memorized, and I'd like to commence with that. It begins with, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." You all know that in Psalm 23. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul, and he leads me in the paths of righteousness, even for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies." Isn't that everybody over there? Psalm 23. "Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup overfloweth," or overrunneth. "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the eternal forever." Started out, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." The Lord is our shepherd, is he not? And we are here during this Days of Unleavened Bread to understand that a little bit better than we have, and to, if you will, stay focused on our Savior, Jesus Christ, who he was, that he was the Son of God, first of all, and then he was the Son of Man, and that he does know you and me, and he's aware of our feelings, our sensitivities. I would like to come back before I close with my final lecture for today and share with you a couple of other thoughts about being over in Jerusalem and tie it in with what I'd like to cover in Luke 19. Do we have people in our church that we have as a captain of our salvation, Jesus Christ, in our church, but do we have people in our church who are at various ends of the pendulum in terms of righteousness? Do we? Sure we do. Sure we do. We have some, for example, that really feel it is wrong to eat a meal on the Sabbath day. We do have some folks that feel that way, and I respect their right to feel that way. We have some folks who will not so much as lift a chair on the Sabbath day to help out, but would so after the setting of the sun. We have various levels of understanding about what is right and what is not right, quote-unquote, within the church. That was not very much unlike the age in which Jesus Christ lived either. And if you had read your little, which you haven't had time to, but if you've read about the Pharisees, you'll understand that to be true, and the Sadducees and the Essenes. When I was in Jerusalem, I was struck by the fact because I thought I would learn a little bit about how to keep the Sabbath. That's a fair question, isn't it? Because I'm bombarded with questions about how to keep the Sabbath all the time. And I thought, well, I'll just go to the very cradle of civilization and find out. So I went over there, and we were in Tel Aviv, and we came down. And one of the very first things I did on Friday is I picked up the newspaper to find out when the sun set. And I was really amused by this. Because now remember, I gave you the map with the geography of Jerusalem. Now let me just show you how it worked over there. The Jerusalem Post said, for Jerusalem, Sabbath is at 5:09. Tel Aviv, which was 45 miles away, the Sabbath was 5:26. Now, why do you think that would be? All right, now remember, this isn't exactly, but it's close. And the city of Jerusalem is situated here, and way over here, 45 miles away, without any mountains in the way, is Tel Aviv. And so the Jews observe the Sabbath beginning with what? A visual observation. And when you're situated here, and there's a mountain in the way, the sun sets earlier. And then when it, over here, I mean, let's face the facts, 17 minutes doesn't come up in 45 miles. But what really tickled me was the sun setting. When the Sabbath is over, I don't remember, I think the sun set for both of them at about 5:30. Now, you know why that is? Because to the west, in Tel Aviv, was the Mediterranean Sea, and there are no mountains there. And to the west of Jerusalem, the mountains were not as high, so guess what you ended up with? You ended up with a visual observation of the setting of the sun approximately the same time. So that taught me a little bit about how the Jews reckon the Sabbath day, in spite of all the controversy we get into in the United States, and we sit there and we say, it's 5:29 counting, 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, we got to check our newspapers. I think there's a lot to be said for that example. Another thing which I was really curious about is, remember I asked you about this word Hasidim, and it's on one of those charts, one of these, I think it's on Pliny here. It's in here somewhere about the Hasidim. The Hasidim were the righteous Jews, the more righteous, the Hasidim Jews. And I was quite curious about what they were going to do on Friday evening. Now here's a problem you run into. If any of you travel to Jerusalem, I want to just inform you that be prepared for this. Friday, out of respect for the Muslim faith, the government offices basically shut down because Friday is the Muslim Sabbath. See? Saturday, everything is shut down because Saturday is the Jewish Sabbath. Sunday is basically shut down because that is the Christian Sabbath. Now, you talk about confusion. You know, I mean, just imagine, you can't do anything on Friday, you can't do anything on Saturday, you can't do anything on Sunday. I mean, you got all these religious faiths at work here. But what I thought was curious, when it was Friday evening, we were looking for a restaurant to eat in. And we were going to go through our normal route, and we went down there, and the roads were barricaded. We couldn't even get through the Hasidic portion of the new city of Jerusalem where the Jews lived. You know why? Because they felt even the driving on the highway of an automobile in the front of their house was a violation of the Sabbath day. I thought it was real curious, and I looked down here, and I really got a charge out of this. Because we're talking about people that are very devout, and I admire that in them, but I thought, I wonder what their kids are doing. And I looked down the road, and their kids were playing soccer. Now, another thing that, maybe they were Gentile kids, but they were out in the street kicking that little ball around, you know. And the other thing I found interesting is when we went to Tel Aviv, we went back on the Sabbath to Tel Aviv, and all the businesses were closed down because I guess they take very strictly that 6 days shall you labor and do all of your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it you shall not do any work. But you know what is open? Restaurants. And the downtown portion, you got the streets here, and they all crisscross, but this downtown square, the main street, is just a festive environment. And moms and dads are out there with their little kids going along in strollers, and they're all rejoicing, and they're eating, and they're having fun. Now, you didn't find any of the Hasidic Jews doing that, because they would not do that. But the mainstream Jewish population was doing that, and I thought, well, that's not really too far from what we do, do you think? Because we do a little bit of that, only thing perhaps we're not quite as festive. And I remember as a young child growing up in the Worldwide Church, I was exposed to these extremes, because when I first came into the church, the way that we kept the Sabbath is, you know, we had to read Scripture. This was not my mother's doing, but who I travel with oftentimes. We had to, if we read anything, it had to be scriptural. If we played any games, it was animal, vegetable, mineral, which had to be out of the Bible. And then you couldn't watch television. And we all, as kids, guess what? We had time down to the very second. I mean, we had it down. We knew exactly when it was going to be over. So I'm glad that the church does not enforce that. Of course, if you do it yourself personally, that's your business. But I did learn a little bit from being over there and observing what the Jews did. It didn't necessarily change what I do, but I found it very interesting that they are a people of devout religious faith and deep convictions. And as a result of that, I can understand why God feels the way he does about them. And I'll also understand why Jesus Christ was so caught up in their emotions and all that makes them so special. There were three special moments that I'd like to share with you that really touched me. One I've already told you about was the Garden Tomb experience. I'll always remember that. The other was when we were down in the port city of Eilat, and it was a Saturday night, I believe. And we were sitting there having dinner. Mark Armstrong and I were sitting there having dinner, and all of a sudden there was some music. Just music, you know. And I looked out, and it was like a mall area in an open square, town square. And just almost on a cue, people by the scores got up and joined arm in arm, three ranks deep, three circles deep, and began to do folk dancing. And I just got caught up in it. I mean, I got through eating, and I went out there, and I leaned on a support beam because I wasn't going to get out there and dance. You know, that would have been a Gentile on the floor. And I would have been very uncomfortable, but it's very danceable music. It's that folk song, you know, the Jewish folk songs. I don't know what they call it. What is it? I'm sorry? Hora. And they had a disc jockey who was orchestrating the whole thing, but I was caught up in it because, you know, in America, you don't dance unless you're cool. You know, either that or you're too old, or, that's just the way it is. I mean, you don't get out and dance unless you got the right logo on your shirt. Here in America, or you got the right girl, but down there, or the right guy, whichever way you want to look at it. But down there, at a certain, they're out. I mean, there's everybody's dancing, the young and the old, the male and the female, and there's no really expression of vanity. They're just out there having a good time, and they dance, and they got through, and they stop, and all of a sudden they play a little music, and then they'd hit a certain note, and they were ready. Everybody knew exactly what to do, and I guess they do this from childhood, and so when they're grown, they know what to do. And I watch those people. I probably watched them for about an hour, and I watched their smiles, and I watched their laughter, and I watched their freedom, and I thought to myself, this is infectious. And I says, this is a part of these people that I know that Jesus Christ would have been in love with. Because even like David, you know, David got out there and danced mightily, did he not? Now, Micah didn't like what he did, but he did dance mightily. Dancing is a part of their life, a part of their mainstream living, and It did something good for me. I don't know how to describe it. It just made me realize that there's something good about that, that brings them together and unites them as a family. And I wish we did more of that in America. But in America, I think we give way too much to vanity and, you know, to the latest thing that's in, you know, and I'm sad about that. But that was something that was moving to me. And then the third thing, which I'm going to tie in directly here, and I like, save your place in Luke 19 if you're over there. And I want you to read something that really struck my mind out of the gospel, out of Acts, rather. Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3. I believe it was on the weekly Sabbath that we were there. Let me read to you what it says here. Peter and John went up together into the temple at about the third hour, or the ninth hour, excuse me, about 3 p.m. And a certain man who was lame from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple. Who, seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked an alms. And Peter, fastening his eyes upon him with John, said, look on us. And he gave heed unto them, expecting to receive something of them. Then Peter said, silver and gold have I none, but such as I have I give you. And in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. And of course his feet and his ankles received strength, and he did so. I read that verse because the third thing that was so touching to me while I was there is the following story. I was a little bit uncomfortable on the Mount of Olives because of all the Arab tension that was there. And so we had come back for a second time. It was on the Sabbath. And Mr. Armstrong was going to make a live audio tape right there on the Mount of Olives, which I think he's probably already announced in a third-class letter or first-class letter. And up on the Mount of Olives, there were a number of Arabs there, one of whom was blind. He was a blind Arab, and I thought maybe it was a gimmick. You know, by now I'm very leery, and I thought, well, this guy is probably faking, you know, because they'll do anything for money. People will do anything for money. But I watched him for a long time. When there were no people around, a couple of young children came and grabbed him by the arms and led him away. And I thought, okay, well, he's probably really blind. Anyway, a few minutes later, about 10 or 15 minutes later, a bus drove up. And now, if I may illustrate this, if I had a picture I could show you, but, you know, I'm here, and there's a road that comes here, and there's another road here, and there's a fence, a little stone fence here, and up here is the Mount of Olives, and, you know, down this way and over here is Jerusalem. And Mr. Armstrong went down right here on a stone wall, about this high, out of sight, and just took out his briefcase, and out of his briefcase, and opened up, took a cassette recorder. And he's sitting down, he doesn't have a suit on, just a casual. And he, all of a sudden, I could hear him, you know, he started talking about, here I am on the Mount of Olives, and I'm looking across the Kedron Brook over to the city of Jerusalem. And so he started just cold, just like that. And I'm sitting there, that sort of sends chills up my spine anyway, to think about it. And I'm watching all of that. And meanwhile, I'm looking over there, and I'm taking a few pictures and absorb. And up on the top, we've got this donkey who's up here, who's normally part of the circus up there. I mean, part of the gimmick to get money. And he is braying like crazy. I'm sure when you hear the tape that Mr. Armstrong made in Jerusalem, believe you me, that is not me or an Arab. That is a true donkey. And a couple of times Mr. Armstrong was doing it, the donkey just brayed with all of its might. Mr. Armstrong looked over at me, and I just went, I don't know. That's one problem I can't solve. I mean, I can't handle that one. But what happened is then a bus drove up, and there were people, tourists like I was, with their noses plastered to the window because they were all a little bit afraid to get out because of the tension up there. They probably shouldn't have been, but they were afraid. And then all of a sudden, it looked, a minister got out. A minister got out and came over here to the edge above Mr. Armstrong, above me here, and he was going to have his picture taken. And I was back. I was watching Mr. Armstrong, and I was watching this up here, and all of a sudden I saw the blind man. And it's just an emotional thing with me because of what I know it says here in Acts 3. And this minister, it looked to be a Greek Orthodox minister, all attired in his finest outfit and all that kind of thing. And somebody was going to take his picture. He was begging for money. And to look up there and hear Mr. Armstrong, one level down, talking about the truth of this week and this day and what we believe, the truth going out, which you're going to hear on that tape. Then up above me, a blind man who wanted just one thing. He wanted money, but you know what he would give? He'd give all the money in the world to have his eyesight back. And he had to be restrained because the Greek Orthodox minister had to have his picture taken up there, and I understand all of that. But it really overcame me because I knew then that one of these days that Jesus Christ was going to come back to that spot and people like that blind man would be healed. And that's pretty special. I wish I could have gone up and healed him. All I can do is pray for him. Well, that day is going to come in that special city, and he will not have to be restrained anymore. And just like James, John and Peter said, listen, we don't have a whole lot to give. I can't give you any silver, and I can't give you any gold, but guess what I can give you? How would you like to see the sunset tonight? What do you think? Pretty special. One of these days, I hope that you and I have that ability and the gift to do so. Now, I was certainly moved by that, and made me go back to the verses I want to share with you here, back to Luke chapter 19. I'm spending a lot of time in Luke chapter 19. Here we have listed a number of people, and I've given all the handouts. I'll ask you to study those if you will. But they're going to be mentioned here, and I've told you, if you'll notice in Luke 18, verse 31, then he took unto him the 12 and said unto them, behold, we go where? Up to Jerusalem. He knew what was going to happen to him. He comes to Jericho in verse 35, and it came to pass that as he was come near unto Jericho, a certain blind man sat by the way, and he's begging. So Jesus is working his way toward Jerusalem. And Jericho is way down in the Rift Valley area, very, very hot down there, and is about 12 miles away from the city of Jerusalem. And he's going to come around the backside of the Mount of Olives to where we're going to find the events in chapter 19. Here we find Jesus says that he entered and passed through Jericho, so he is on the other side of it. And here he beholds a man, Zacchaeus, who was a publican. What can you tell me about a publican? What do you know about him? He's a tax collector. No, that's right, it's what he was. And he was one, was he in favor or disfavor? Did the people like him or not, normally? Why didn't they like him? Because he would do this. He would charge the people too much money, more so than the Roman government expected him to, and what would he do with the money that was too much? He would go to Eilat. No, he would pocket it. He was an extortionist, you see. Now, can God call an extortionist? Sure he can. Now, this is interesting to me. There are several things in this story that I find very thrilling as we get very close to the time that Jesus Christ is going to come up to the city of Jerusalem and weep over it. Here he comes to Zacchaeus in verse 2, who was a publican. Now, not only was he a publican, but there was something else about him that was equally irritating. He was rich. You know, we have problems in our society today, too. We have problems. You know, I used to think this word was Republicans. A long time ago, when I was reading this, I thought, publicans. That's awfully close to Republicans. And, could be. But no, it's not. It's publicans. And he was rich. But here's what's interesting. He sought to see Jesus, who he was, but he could not press, or could not for the press, because he was apparently a short fellow. All right? Now, this is what I find here. He ran before and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide in your house. Now, what we find here is something that's very commendable. The publican, Zacchaeus, we find it commendable, his desire to come and see Jesus. But you know what else is more commendable? His desire to see Jesus is surpassed by the fact that Jesus wanted to see him. Because that's what Jesus said here. For today, I must abide in your house. Now, has the thought ever crossed your mind that God wants to see you too? Just ponder that a moment. I don't care whether you're short, tall, male, or female. I don't care whether you're in the peak of health or whether you're, I do care if you're not feeling well. But you know what I'm saying. Do you think that God has ever wanted to just spend time with you? Quality time? Today is my day to be with Frank Morang. Now, we know that he is in you through the giving of his Holy Spirit. But just think about that. Here Jesus Christ singled this man out who was of small stature, and he was basically disliked by the Pharisees. Why? Well, because of his reputation. Now notice what happens here in verse 7. And when they saw it, they all murmured. Why? Saying that he was to be a guest of a man that is a what? He was a sinner. The Pharisees had a real problem here, with this, the people that were traveling with him. And it's rather complicated. I want you to turn back with me to Luke chapter 15. Hold your place in Luke 19. I want you to see this. Luke chapter 15. If you will look at the captions in this chapter, Luke 15, what are the three parables in this chapter? Can somebody tell me? There are three parables. What's the first one? That's an interesting word, a lost sheep. Let me ask you this. What do you think, what's the message, the moral of the lost sheep? What do you think? There are several that you could draw from it, but what does it mean to you? Okay, everyone's equal, but also God then is interested in people who are lost. Can we just say that? Because it is a lost sheep. Okay, the number two one is what? A lost coin. Now, what's the morale of that? By the way, I understand that better now because I saw some pictures of the floors of the average house in Jerusalem. It's not linoleum. It's stones. And if you lose a quarter, if you will, or a shekel, it easily can fall down in the little crevices in the stone. So it's not like you just sort of get down on the floor and look at it and find it, because it gets down in the crack where the stones don't fit together nicely, and you can't. It's very difficult to find. So the lost coin and the story behind that is what? You rejoice in one that something has been lost and you find it, okay? Now, how about the third one, which is the lost son? The story of the prodigal son. And what's the lesson of that? You rejoice when he returns and you find him. Okay. Now this particular chapter, Jesus gives these three parables to answer accusation made by the scribes and the Pharisees. Notice, if you will, in Luke 15, "Then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, This man receives sinners and eats with them." That's an interesting expression here. He eats with them. If you will notice now, still in Luke 18, we're going to come back there. Come to Luke chapter 5. And I want you to notice something there. Luke chapter 5, over in about verse 29. We find that this, beginning in verse 27, deals with the selection of one disciple whose name was what? Levi, who was actually Matthew. All right? Levi was a tax collector, correct? The receipt of custom. And he said unto him, "Follow me." And he left all and rose up and followed him. And Levi made him a great feast in his own house. And there was a great company of publicans and of others. Do you know who the others were? Notice in verse 9, it mentions publicans and sinners. So the way this is looked at, we have just two groups of people. We have publicans and sinners. So Levi made him a great feast in his own house, and there was a great company of publicans and others, sinners, that sat down with him. But their scribes and Pharisees murmured against his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with publicans and sinners?" And Jesus answering said to them, "They that are whole need not a physician, but they that are sick." There's something I pondered about that. They were really rankled a little bit because, according to a certain amount of logic, who should he have invited to his dinner? I mean, who should Matthew have invited to his home for dinner? Well, if you're quote-unquote being converted, I mean, I agree that he should have, but logic says, like in the church, sometimes we exclude those who are not of our own number. And what I find here is that, you know, the dinner table was open to other people than those who were just disciples. You understand the way I'm going here? In other words, at church services, a good place to bring somebody who's not a disciple yet is a neighbor or a fellow sinner, someone who is not yet converted. Because that's really what he's doing here. Rather than just inviting the disciples of Christ, Levi goes ahead and invites those that were his former friends, publicans and sinners. And that just angered the Pharisees and the scribes. Just made them so mad they could spit. You know, they didn't like that at all. Now, there's more to that than you might catch at the first eye. Because there was something that was very unique. Remember, we already read this over in Luke chapter 18 that, you know, that they were going to share the same table. There was something in the Jewish tradition, if you will, especially as dictated by the Pharisees, that who you ate dinner with was very, very important. That's the reason why in so many examples that you read here, there's always a dinner table involved, food involved, breaking of bread. Because that violated one of the most sacrosanct Jewish traditions of all, and that is who you eat with, you agree with them. Who you eat with is one of your own kind. As a matter of fact, what Jesus did was next to, just paramount, just next to committing the same sins that these sinners and publicans would have been committing. And it just made them so angry they couldn't accept it. It was too much for them. Especially realizing Jesus was who he was. Now, one other thing I want you to think about when we sort of wind focused here a little bit. When you go back and you read that when Jesus was a young man, who came up out of, it says that certain from Judah and Judea came up to see him. Would you care to speculate who might be some of those people who came up to see and to attest to some of the miracles that he did up in Galilee? Who do you think that might have been? Who would have been most threatened by someone who could perform miracles? The religious leaders. And the reason why I'm proposing this to you is I suspect that this, all we read here in Luke 18, 19, 20 is predated by the fact that the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes, they already knew quite a bit about Jesus. And they were worried about him. But they could never trap him. Now remember, he lived north in a little town of Galilee, which was next to the Sea of Galilee. I mean, he lived in Nazareth, And let me just, it's not exactly right, but you've got the Sea of Galilee here, and then you've got the Jordan River down here, and then you've got the Dead Sea, and you've got Jerusalem right here. He lived about right in here, a good distance away from Jerusalem. And people would have had to come up to see him because his early works were right here on the very border of the Sea of Galilee. So there would have been those leaders who would have come up to see him, and he would have been well known. Because as we read all these examples, we find that he is being dogged by the religious leaders of the day. Now, let's go on just a little bit farther, if we may. Let's come back to Luke 18 now. Let's come to Luke 19. The most important verse, so commentaries say, you be the judge of your own. The most important verse in the entire book of Luke, especially in Luke 19, they claim is Luke 10. Luke 19 and verse 10, where it says, "For the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which was lost." All right? Goes back, the reference to Luke 15, where we had the lost son, we had the lost coin, and we had the lost sheep. Jesus Christ had come to save those which were lost. That would have flown in the face of the religious leaders because they thought that they were saved or found. Now, let's notice what else he says. "And as they heard these things, he added," so he's going to add on to what he's already stated, "and he spoke a parable." What's this parable about? Let's read it here a little bit. It's the parable of a certain nobleman. And I think this is important for us today. Parable of a certain nobleman. Let's read through it just briefly to catch the story flow. It says here, "He went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return." I want to make... He went, and he's going to return. Let's keynote certain verses here, certain words. "And he called unto him 10 servants. How many servants? 10 servants. "And he delivered unto them 10 pounds. Now, do all of you have... They weren't actually pounds. They were, I guess they call them minas, M-I-N-A, which is a very small amount of money. But 10 pounds would have basically represented 3 months' wages. So that's a pretty fair amount of money. He gave them a good amount of money. So I'm going to say 10 minas, or mina. Maybe that's the plural. I really don't know. And he tells them, he says, listen, he said his citizens hated him, and he sent a message after him saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. And it came to pass that when he was returned, having received a kingdom," then he did what while he was gone? He received a kingdom, didn't he? While he was gone. "Then he commanded those servants to be called to him to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. So here came the first." So out of the 10, he chooses how many? Out of the 10, because he did choose 10, did he not? But out of the 10, he only highlights 3. So he begins to deal with the first, and he says, the first one says, "Lord, your pound has gained 10 pounds. And he said unto him, well, you good servant, because you have been faithful or trustworthy in a very little, you have..." That's an interesting expression, very little, isn't it? I wonder what he meant by very little. What do you think he meant by that? "Because you've been trustworthy in very little." By comparison to what? That's exactly right. You've been very, you know, you were trustworthy with the 10 mina, but in comparison, that was a small test when you compare it to the magnificent reward of the kingdom of God. And actually, here he gives him 10 cities, you see. Very little, he says, "I'm going to give you 10 cities. Now, we'll see something here in a minute about that. "And so the second came saying to him, Lord, you gained 5 pounds. And he said, likewise to him, be you also over 5 cities. Not quite as much recommendation here, not quite as much of a compliment. "Another came saying, behold, here's your pound, which I have kept laid up in a napkin, for I feared you, because you are an austere man. You take up that you lay not down, and you reap that you did not sow." And what I notice about this verse in verse 21 is that there was a great deal of conservatism at least being talked about here because of fear. And I believe, is it not, 1 John 4 says, perfect love casts out fear. All right? In other words, if this man had not feared, we have to let our minds run as to what he would do. And sometimes we ourselves are restrained by fear. Rather than utilizing what it is that God has given to us, we don't, because we're frightened and we're scared. And then, of course, he says, out of your own mouth in verse 22, will I judge you? Sort of an interesting story, don't you think? There's a parallel story over in Matthew chapter 25. Let's turn over there real quickly because there is something in comparison I want you to see. Matthew chapter 25, that's called the parable of what? I'm sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. Over in verse 14. Matthew 25, I believe it is, verse 14. All right, that's the parable of, I'm going to put talents here. So over here in Luke's account, we have them called parable of the pounds or minas, M-I-N-A, and here they're called the parable of the talents. Now, do you think this is one and the same parable? Have any of you ever studied it? Do you think it's the same example, the same story? Well, let's notice some of the differences. Let's read through that. Do you see any differences right off the bat? What are they? What are some of the differences? Let me just list some of the things that are in there.
He gave the first one 10 pounds for, and Luke gave him 8 pounds.
Okay, so the amount of money entrusted is different. So let me put that on there. The dollar figure entrusted, different. Dollar figure, different, okay? What else? The number of servants involved is different. Right? I believe in Matthew 25 it's 3. In Luke it was 10 that he chose. Okay. Let's put number of servants here. You all agree with that? Okay. Mr. Justice said what? There's slightly different phraseology in Matthew's account to abilities. And there's something else. What is it? The reward. No. The reward is not the same.
Well, I mean, not the same as over the word Luke.
Right.
The same for...
Because what is not mentioned in Luke, I mean, in Matthew's account?
Yeah.
What is not mentioned? The number of cities.
Yeah.
No number. Okay, so there are differences here. And what I'm trying to say, there's a lot of controversy about whether or not these are one and the same. I'm not going to debate that with you because I don't think the issue here are the difference in the similarities is not the issue. What is important is what's exemplified and expanded in Luke's account, which is what, if you go back to Luke now, you will find that what is really portrayed is the one rejected. And who is the one rejected? It is the king. He was rejected. And who is that for all of us who are aware of the second coming of Jesus Christ? It's him. All right. Now let me show you something else about this parable back to Luke's account, if you will turn back there now with me. In Luke's account, I want you to go back to the parable. I'm going to call it, just for the sake of difference. Does anybody really know, is it called a mina or a, is that what it's called? Parable of, who knows Hebrew or Greek? It's all Greek to me. I want you to, we read through quickly that parable. I want you to tell me the lessons of Luke 18, Luke 19, this parable here, the mina. What are they? What does it portray about this king who leaves and is gone for a while and comes back and receives this kingdom while he's gone? What are the lessons in that for you? Okay, let me list somebody, some of them. Realistically, and I think in the story that's given, it realistically portrays the coming rejection. The coming rejection and future return of Jesus Christ. Okay? Would you all agree with that? I mean, it does illustrate that. He's going to go and he's going to come back. Okay? Now, hear that out the rest of it. Number two, it clarifies. The appearance, or the time, sorry, time of the coming of the kingdom. Because the disciples thought it was going to happen when? Immediately. So this clarifies this. Okay? The third thing it does, it delineates And this, I think, is very important. The role of the disciple while he is gone. I know you may be not be able to read this. The fourth thing it does, and it's tied in closely with this, it teaches that Jesus predicted an interval. I know these are very, very closely related to you. This number three is pretty important to me because this happened. This is history now, this rejection, although he's not come back yet. This is something that's ahead. This is right now. I mean, is it not true? You and I are living right now in this parable as it's told while he's away, waiting for him to come back, the rejected one. Now, let's read on just a little bit farther if we may. Back here to Luke. We don't have time to go over all these papers. I just ask you to read them because I want you to see what happens now. Now we come to verse 28. And when he had thus spoken, he went before ascending up to Jerusalem. So here he comes up to the city. And it came to pass when he was come near to Bethage, which is just below. Remember I showed you that this morning. You know, you have the, you remember here was the Mount of Olives up here. And he came apparently along the back side. And he stopped at Bethpage first. And he's going to come up here to Bethany. Now Bethany, which is this location right prior to the mountain, top of the Mount of Olives, is that Bethage was where Mary and Martha and Lazarus lived. So here he comes up to Bethany at the mount called the Mount of Olives, and he sent two of his disciples. And of course, I think you know what they did. They went out and got this colt, and he is going to ride into the city on it, which he does. And you notice in verse 37, and when he was come near, even now at the descent, remember how I told you? Remember how deep that trough was to the Kedron Valley? Well, he's up on the other side of it, see? He's up here, and this is the Kedron Valley, and over here is the city of Jerusalem, and it's located about like this, with this being north. And he's up here, and he's got to descend here, all right? So he is going to descend the Mount of Olives. It says, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen. It's pretty exciting. This is called his triumphant entry into the city of Jerusalem. That's what people call it, his triumphant entry into the city of Jerusalem. And they're even singing praises to it. But notice in verse 39, and some of the Pharisees from among the multitude said to him, Master, rebuke your disciples. They didn't like what was going on. Right? Now, I can understand that a little bit because when we were at the Wailing Wall, we were taking some last-minute footage, and I had already checked the newspaper. So I knew what time they said the sun was going to set, whether I agreed with it or not. I was a Gentile in their country. We were at the Wailing Wall, and I was really getting uneasy. Because I was watching my clock, and I kept telling Mark and Alan, who were doing the photography, I said, we better get out of here. I'll tell you what, now we better get out of here. And up ahead on the Wailing Wall, some of you have been there, it was just a spectacle to me. It was a show, and it was somewhat of a disgrace, because there were literally people who were there were putting on an absolute frightening show of righteousness. And I don't need to portray it, but I mean, you know, they were there, and they're just bobbing away, and they're writing little messages and ticking, putting them in the wall, and all sorts of fanfare. People were over on the side arguing, because now we had three of them together. All sorts of pitched emotions, and I'm aware of the sun setting down. And up on the Wailing Wall are soldiers with guns. And I remembered at the Feast of Tabernacles, when we were all keeping the feast here last year, 21 Jews were killed right there. Because what happened during the Feast of Tabernacles last year? There was a group called the Temple Faithful who made a move to bring a 3,000-pound cornerstone into the Wailing Wall area. They were actually going to put it up on the Temple Mount area. And everything got completely out of proportion. The next thing you know, the Arab population felt that something was out of sorts. They got all excited. Hundreds of them took stones and threw them over the Wailing Wall, and they fell on these pious, righteous Jews that eventually wounded a number of them. The Jews got all excited then, and they were phoning ahead with some of the soldiers. The Arabs surrounded a little guardhouse in which there were two Jewish soldiers inside of it. But what they didn't know is that they let them go. But when the Jewish militia got there, they just opened fire. And next thing you know, there are 21 Arabs laying dead in the streets. And it happened just like that. I can't tell you how quickly it happened. Just because things were out of control, and really there was nothing to be alarmed about. So here you have this Pharisee, you have these people who can put on quite a demonstration. Anyway, it got to be about 5:09. I'm saying to Mark, we got to get out of here. Well, about 5:09, soldiers came over. And believe me, we got out. I mean, they said, no more pictures. They didn't have to say it twice for me. I mean, I said, I'm out of here. We're dragging the cord up. We are out of here. But it made me realize a little bit about that city and how rigid and how inflexible they are. Some of these people today that we would call Pharisees, if you will, very righteous and devout people that Jesus himself had to encounter and resist, even as we find it in verse 39. Jerusalem, which kill the prophets and stone them that are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen does gather her brood under her wings? And he says, and you wouldn't have anything to do with it. And here we come into chapter 19, which we're back to. And when he was come finally into the area, he came near into it. He beheld the city, and he just wept. And I'll tell you this, I understand it a lot better than I did before. And notice now in verse 42, saying, if you had known, even you, at least in this your day, the things which belong unto your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the day shall come upon you that your enemy shall cast a trench about you and compass you around and keep you in on every side. And I cannot help but notice the irony of that, because they are surrounded by those that would like to see their demise and see them fall. He says, and shall lay you even with the ground and your children within you, and they shall not leave in you one stone upon another. And we could talk about the wall. That's another story completely, but they are magnificent. There will not be one stone left upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation. What's interesting to me about that is that we do. You know, we Gentiles over here, we know about it. And as I close, I just want you to remember, if you will, in your mind's eye, which I am very poorly able to state to you. It's just something that's inside my heart and be locked with me forever. That image, the imagery, if you will, of being on the Mount of Olives, and just the emotion of knowing that down below was the true message, and Mr. Armstrong making a tape and telling the truth, and up above us was a mockery and falsehood and a need, a man who was blind who needed to be healed, and he wasn't, but one day he would be. And if I may close and just leave you with a message, you know, the days of unleavened bread are focused for us. They're focused upon Jesus Christ and his sacrifice, taking him in every single day as we've had unleavened bread today. We remember a little prayer. Actually, it wasn't a prayer. It was just a little misstatement that a child made when he was asked to recite, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He said, recite that. I think his name was Roy. And Roy, the little boy Roy, said, all right, he did. He said, my Lord, the Lord is my shepherd, and he's all I want. Maybe that's enough.